tonight on Arena. We review The Beast in Me, Summer Water and Wild Cherry on TV, and new music from Rosalia, Nightmares on Wax and Blonde Shell. You are very welcome along to Friday night's Arena. You can text us on 51551. Our WhatsApp is 0870 32 32 32. Email arena at rte.ie. And we are on Instagram at rte underscore arena. We start with TV, as usual. Three shows up for discussion tonight. First, Claire Danes has a lot to be tense about in The Beast in Me. It's a new eight-part psychological thriller on Netflix. Her young son died in a car accident. She has an estranged ex-wife. She's cash-strapped and she has writer's block. And that's before suspected wife killer Matthew Rhys moves in next door. Next, Shirley Henderson and Dougray Scott are just two of the unhappy holidaymakers in the picturesque but eerie group of cabins of Summerwater. It's a six-part drama based on the best-selling Sarah Moss novel on Channel 4. And finally, mothers and daughters are in trouble in the wealthy enclave of Richford Lake in Wild Cherry. It's a new drama on BBC One starring Eve Best and Carmen Ejogo as mothers Juliet and Lorna, who are called to the school one day about a video their teenager are accused of posting online. Jen Gannon and Chris Wasser have been watching all three for us and they are in studio with me. First to The Beast in Me, this is Claire Danes and Matthew Rhys locking horns in a thriller which ratchets up the tension from the opening scene. I'm going to start with a little something from it. Let's hear the moment that she finds out who her new neighbour is.
Nice little jogging path might be good for you. Not to mention, it'll raise property values. All your neighbours seem to think so. In fact, you're the only one who hasn't signed off.
Oh, maybe I prefer the woods unpaved.
Huh. I see. Wow. You,
what?
You want a payout?
Excuse me?
Why, it's not enough that I'm covering all the costs. You want me to write you a check, too?
What? No, I don't want your money. Jesus.
I admit it. I'll admit it. I did not see this coming. National treasure? Agatha Wiggins? What's the expression? Don't meet your heroes? Well, I guess we all have bills to pay, huh?
Yeah, all due respect. You don't know anything about me.
Well, I know print media isn't exactly booming and you haven't published anything since your little boy died. That can't be easy.
Don't mention my son.
That is Claire Danes playing Aggie Wiles, a Pulitzer Prize-winning author of a memoir about her difficult relationship with her dad, and that's the least of her troubles. Chris, what else do we need to know about Aggie?
About Aggie? Well, she used to have it all. She had this picture-perfect life in this enormous gated community living among the wealthiest people in the state. She had a loving wife, Shelley, played by Natalie Morales, a beautiful son, a lucrative book deal with the publisher, with one of the best publishers in New York, following that memoir that you mentioned that she wrote about her turbulent relationship with her father. It all came tumbling down after the death of her son, who died in a car crash. And the other driver may have been drunk, but was never charged. There's a subplot there about how, you know, he never took a breathalyzer and the police never charged him. So she has to live her life seeing this young man every single day and knowing that, you know, there's no justice there. But her marriage imploded after that. The book that she was working on about Ruth Bader Ginsburg is falling apart because she's just not all that interested in it. So it is actually the perfect time for that gentleman played by Matthew Rhys named Niall Jarvis to move next door, because what we learn about Niall Jarvis is that he may not have killed his wife. His wife disappeared 6 years ago. He was the prime suspect in the investigation, was never charged with anything, but the country made its mind up. They looked at this wealthy, slippery, and let's face it, a little bit sleazy, you know, he's not very easy to warm to, as you could hear in that clip there, property tycoon. He's a real estate mogul, and they said, this guy is guilty. So he moves in next door, and he has this fractious relationship with Aggie because she's the only one who won't sign this deal that will allow him to build a jogger's path out the back. And in their first encounter, and then their lunch, and then getting to know one another, he mentioned something in passing about how you should stop working on the book that you're working on because it's clearly not that interesting and write something about me. And that's when alarm bells start ringing for both Aggie and the viewer, because we realise she's going to write a book about the potential wife killer.
I mean, Jen, all the rich, evil billionaire property developer wants to do is just build a jogging path through the woods. Is that too much to ask?
Hey, let him. I'd let him, probably. I mean, I think this is a great, bizarre meet-cute between the two of them when they go for lunch. And he is so disarming. Matthew Rhys is great at playing slippery psychopaths in a way. I mean, if anybody, I think one of his best performances ever was in an episode, standalone episode of Girls in the final season, where he plays this very beguiling author who has been cancelled by these millennials, and Lena Dunham's character comes to interview him and they go through the rubrics of cancel culture and everything, and she comes out of it pre something that happens very charmed by him. And it's the same here. He's very good at this, and he's very good at, you can see Claire Danes' character not exactly wanting to get involved with him, but finding him fascinating. And she's lived her life cloistered within this massive house that's fallen down. So, you know, the divorce, the grief of it all. And he is injecting life back into her by just questioning her and saying to her, you know, this memoir that you wrote about your dad, it may sound like, you know, it was a hatchet job about your father, but I think it's about you trying to reckon with the fact that you do like him, even though he's a terrible person, because he's just like me and terrible people exist. And what are you going to do? And it's this joust between, this ping pong match, this mental verbal ping pong match between Claire Danes and Matthew Rhys, which is electrifying to watch. And that's why people want to watch this show, because really underneath it all, it's pretty soapy.
Yeah.
Like you realise that by Agatha getting into writing this book, she is going to be pulled into the case herself and think, well, did he kill his, you know, ex-wife, or what's happening here? And
I never thought that for a moment.
She's, you know, getting involved with this shambly FBI agent, and put, you know, he's still on the trail of Matthew Rhys's character. So that is pretty much your standard thriller. But it's these two performances of these two powerhouses going at it in this very strange way, a kind of a pulling at each other's threads about what you think about human nature and your worst behaviour, the beast inside, the beast in me. What does that all mean? And can that be controlled? And is that necessarily a bad thing? And I like all those ideas. And I think they're pumping through those scenes with those two actors.
Talk to me about that tension, Chris, because Aggie lives in, I mean, it's a perfect house for a horror story initially, which it isn't, but for a thrill, this kind of fairly ramshackle but at the same time rich person house, which is all kind of falling apart at the seams, and people start knocking at the door in the middle of the night, and she's all on her own apart from that wonderful cute little dog, which I worry about very much from the very beginning.
Stephen, yeah.
It made me feel very uncomfortable that she had this dog, because my fear is that something's going to happen to him. Antonio Campos is the guy who directs the first episode. How does he handle all of that tension? Is it done well?
Yeah, he actually like frames it almost like a horror film at times, especially when it comes time to meet the FBI agent. Brian Abbott is his name, played by David Lyons. It's almost like there's a monster at the door. Aggie wakes up in the middle of the night, and if it's not the strange noises in her house, because the plumbing in her house is basically failing, that are freaking her out, it's the security hired by Niall to basically keep an eye on her. It's his dogs. You know, he's got like these huge Rottweilers that are constantly barking at the door. Now she has the FBI. There is a bit of a horror sensibility at times. I'm sorry as well that I actually laughed at her dog's name being Stephen, because Niall does laugh at it at one stage, and then we learned that her late son named him that because he wanted a real person's name for the dog. It's weird because she's living in this house that's completely falling apart, and she's ignoring the fact that, you know, she hasn't got any money coming in, her gigs have all dried up. And then when you go across to Niall, he's just living in this big mansion, not by himself, there is a wife there, but his, you know, his empire is starting to come together, and Aggie's is basically falling apart. So she realizes that, you know, she needs him. I probably could have done without the FBI stuff. I think if this idea had come about in the 90s, it would have made for a killer thriller, 2 hours on the big screen, and that's it, done. But here it's kind of like, okay, we've 8 episodes, we need to draw this out a little bit. And the stuff about the FBI agent, a couple of FBI agents who are romantically involved, and what they may have been investigating before, cover-ups, it's all a bit too much. The most interesting thing about this is that dynamic between Claire Danes and Matthew Rhys.
Okay,
you don't care about the FBI.
No, not at all.
You really don't.
This is what everybody is here for. It's this piece here. So look, this is Niall being the unpleasant manipulator. It's a lunch that he insists on having in public with Aggie.
Had to do something with all that Pulitzer money, right?
Yeah, the prize itself isn't much, but But yeah, it did well.
I remember. The book was everywhere. Did you send your father a cut? Of the royalties?
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe I should have. And we don't speak.
Is that right? Sacrifices we make for greatness.
I suppose.
Well, it's a shame, though. It sounds like he misread it. I mean, yes, you aired some dirty laundry, but you clearly worship the man.
As a child.
Oh, bullshit. And now. He made you what you are. He was ruthless. He was creative.
He's a con man and a fraud.
But he made people believe.
Most sociopaths do.
You say what you want. You ask me, that book is a love letter. So what are you writing now? Another memoir?
And no, it's a book about Ruth Bader Ginsburg and her friendship with Antonin Scalia, which he obviously doesn't like. Jen, more rich Americans with dangerous secrets. We had this conversation weeks ago here, and now here's the conversation again.
I know, and I should be, I mean, I said I don't want another show about rich Americans, but I like what the textures that this has and brings to it, because I think, you know, with someone like Claire Danes, she is great. She's so good when she's in crisis. You know, Homeland, even My So-Called Life, like even Fleischman Is in Trouble. She's so good at dialing in to someone who is in this fraught state. And she does it so well here that you can be intoxicated by just that relationship. What is it about this man who's almost like a Robert Durst? It's kind of the Jinx almost character. What is it about these people that makes them so attractive? What do we find about ourselves when we're looking into the void? Is it staring back at us kind of thing? And that's enjoyable. And also you have his family drawn into it. I mean, his father's played by Jonathan Banks, and they're very worried about what's going to happen with this memoir, obviously, because they think it will make it look like he's guilty. But who wants to buy the book if he's innocent? So these are all the questions that are pumping through this, which is really interesting. And I mean, it's not the second coming of television, like people have been saying. It really isn't. It's a good thriller with very good performances tacked onto it. That's what it is.
Okay, give me some stars.
I will give it 3.5. It's easy to get carried away by the great performances, I think. But when you're looking at the nuts and bolts of it, it's a bit creaky.
Okay, Chris?
Yeah, I agree with Jen. When Claire Danes is fraught and stressed, I'm interested. You know, she does it better than anyone else. And she's a wonderful rapport with Matthew Rhys. They're both required to do and say silly things here. There's an entire scene in the second episode where Matthew Rhys, God love him, has to eat an entire chicken. And I don't know what the pro showmakers are trying to tell us. Look at this guy. Look what he's capable of doing, eating a whole chicken by himself.
In front of his dogs, starving, yeah. But they weren't going to attack him.
And the rest goes in the bin. But the two of them elevate what could have been a very ordinary, forgettable show. So I'm going to stick with it. 3 stars.
Okay, next to Summer Water, Sarah Moss's novel has been brought to the screen for Channel 4. It's no ad for holidaying in the Scottish countryside, though, no matter how beautiful it is. The first thing to say is we're going to preview this rather than review it because it's embargoed until Sunday. Jen, we're in another beautiful rural location for another thriller, except this time it is in the United Kingdom. It's in Scotland. The highest of high stakes, signalled from the off. Tell us about the holiday park that we begin in here that carries this feeling of dread, and about the Tyndall family. They're the focus of the very first episode.
First of all, I would hate to be dragged here. You're talking about literal cabin fever. It's the most depressing holiday venue I think I've ever seen. So it's situated somewhere in the pointy part of Scotland and near the lochs. It's all damp grass, grey skies, rain, rain, rain. And it is truly grim up north. So you have all these families. It follows the lives of the various holidaymakers within the cabins and how their lives intersect, their stories intertwine when a fire breaks out in the park. And each episode is told from the perspective of a different residence, beginning with their current story, and then they're flashing back to each of the family or the couple's origin story or their past and how they came to be at Summerwater, what they might be hiding, and who they really are. So classic whodunit here. And you start with Justine Tyndall, played Fillane.
Yeah.
So she's a very highly strung woman who has taken her family to Summerwater in a bid, I suppose, to have this nostalgic family, old school family holiday. And she's there to also recuperate from a very stressful time in her life with health issues and also with her job. But she seems to be slipping out of control, completely isolating herself from her husband, retreating into a kind of a fantasy world as her husband sets his sight on a young hotel worker. And the hotel worker is part of a another family that are in a cabin next to them who are playing banging techno into the small hours and cause a massive disruption. So that tension is already there straight from the off, but then you cycle back into Justine's life and why she was having these health problems and what was going on with work and what may have led her to escape her surroundings to Summer Water.
Okay, this is where we hear from Justine for the first time, but she's in an interrogation room.
There were 5 cabins at Summer Water. 4 groups of people on holiday. And a family that works in the hotel. And we need to figure out what happened. Whether this fire was an accident. Can you shed any light on that for us, Justine?
Look, I'm not prejudiced against anyone. But these people, they put everyone's backs up. The woman didn't even know where her own child had run off to. It was just a reckless vibe about them, is all I'm saying. And there was this really odd thing. The woman, she kept taking pictures of me, like she was spying on me. That's not normal. If you ask me, I'd be talking to her.
Okay, Chris, Justine Tindall, played by Villaine Kane. She has a lot to deal with, but she's obviously not the only stressed inhabitant here at Summer Water. Who are David and Annie Dougray-Scott and Shirley Henderson?
Yeah, this is the story I found most interesting, though. So David, played by Dougray-Scott, he is a doctor with unresolved anger issues, father issues, and everything else that comes with it. He has quite the temper too, and he started to resent Annie, played by Shirley Henderson, his wife of 30 odd years, because of her illness. She is showing signs of dementia, and instead of looking after her properly, he's just reckless with her. He's quite physically abusive with her, and he's spending most of his time as they have this day. I mean, all of the entire series is going to take place over a day, switching, you know, from different viewpoints, but on this day that they spend out together on this hike and going for lunch, he's stuck in the past in his head, and he's thinking about this this relationship that he had, that he initiated with a patient some 30 odd years ago, I think at the beginning of his relationship with Annie. And so that side's the same way with Villaine. It was kind of dipping into, you know, her work life and a little bit of a relationship with her husband, and also this worrying medical prognosis. For David, it's going back 30 years to kind of show you this was an episode that shaped him, and this is something that, you know, this is basically a time in his life that he regrets or that he thinks about every day, and this is why he's so angry today. And we also see that despite the fact that Annie is showing signs of dementia, she knows exactly what's going on in the relationship. She knows that the love has completely run out. She knows that he wants rid of her, you know, and he tries to kind of, you know, run away at one point, and he just can't bring himself to do it. That for me was probably the most powerful story. I don't know how much of that had to do with the fact that it was Dougray-Scott and Shirley Henderson, because they're both brilliant, but again, it's just, they're two stories that we've discussed. There's another tree, so there's a lot going on in here.
Jen, given the nature of the way the stories are told here, does it feel episodic?
It's, yeah, it can be quite clunky. There's no getting away from the fact that it was written as different vignettes in the book, and that interweaving text is very hard to replicate, I think, on screen. You're moving from resident to resident, then you're flashing forward to them in the police interview room, and then back to their past. And I think the inner workings of the characters are hard to drill into in a satisfying way, except for maybe the David and Annie story. That's done very successfully, I do think. But there are ways that you can weave an ensemble show into something more coherent. Like if you look at something like Broadchurch, they did it so well with that. But I think Summer Water is going for something else. There's a supernatural element to it. It has this heightened feeling to it. I felt it was almost like a gothic novel at some points. It's dark and brooding, and all the characters have a hyper realism to them. It gives it this very dreamlike quality. So I don't know if that will have a massive appeal to people wanting a straight down the line whodunit thriller type of episodic show, which is, it will be, I don't know, it'll be a weird sell. And also I just think you cannot use Roy Orbison's In Dreams post David Lynch, and they do use it here, and it's as if to signpost it to your audience, to your viewers, going, this is surreal, guys, get with it. Yeah. It's going to be surreal. And I think that it does have this flair, it has this box of tricks, visual style-wise that it wants to use, but I don't know if it uses it as effectively as it could with the actual story itself.
Okay, how many stars are we talking about?
Oh, if it's a preview, I don't...
we're not doing stars on previews, of course.
Under wraps.
Let me rephrase
my own mind.
I will rephrase my question, Councillor. Is it the sort of thing you'd watch more of?
I think like the stories have this... Some stories have more of a level of intrigue than others within the show. And I think it takes its sweet time to get to the point to some of those stories as well. But the essence of something engaging here, especially I think with someone like Shirley Henderson's performance, is really great.
And Chris, for you?
Yeah, I think we all know holidays can be stressful and hell is other people, and the show kind of doubles down on that idea. Whereas from what I understand, I haven't read the novel deals with themes of these post-Brexit themes, these characters who, despite all the stress that's going on in their lives, they're worrying themselves with these awful prejudices, you know, and they're constantly asking questions about the people next door because they're not from the UK. That sort of thing was very prevalent in the novel, I'm told, but it's kind of buried in here a little bit. So if anything, I will keep with it, but I actually would like to pick up the book by Sarah Moss. I think I'll give that a go. So yeah, I'll come back to it.
Okay, finally.
One or another.
Finally to Wild Cherry. Okay, this is a new drama for the BBC. It's another wealthy neighbourhood, a British one this time, Richford Lake, nicely named, where supermum and author Juliet and business mogul Lorna are best friends, as are their teenage daughters. But on the first day of school, those teens, Allegra, played by Amelia May, and Grace, played by Imogen Fairs, are called to the headmaster's office, as are their mothers, played by Eve Best and Carmen Ejogo. They stand accused of posting a suggestive video online.
Can we see the video?
As Ms. Kamen explained to your parents, the video was deleted before we could apprehend the phone, but you were identified.
I mean, I do make videos, but I would never post that sort of content. This is offensive. Mm. And if one of our peers is making up rumours about us, then we have a right to know who it is.
We are not able to reveal the name of the pupil, but I do need to ask whether someone pressured you to film something.
No. No.
Girls. Video might disappear, but reputations last forever.
Are you saying we were being sexual with each other? Oh, sorry, am I making you all feel uncomfortable?
It's okay if you and Grace are exploring. Is that what this is?
No, we're not. We haven't made any video. We're being accused of something we haven't done without any proof. I have never sent a video of myself in underwear, ever. This meeting is patronising and violent.
Don't get upset. It is possible they've been misidentified. I mean, if Allegra says she hasn't recorded a video, I believe her.
Okay, Chris, Allegra showing some attitude. You think the Big Little Lies has a lot to answer for?
It really does, yeah. I love Big Little Lies. I've probably said it far too many times here. But this idea of, you know, rich, obnoxious pals closed off in this, you know, fabulous gated community from the realities of the outside world, all headed towards some sort of bloody disaster. And the show kind of teases that bloody disaster from the beginning and also has this weird framing device where you're seeing, you know, either police interviews or, you know, the characters after an event that changed their lives. That's what we got in Big Little Lies, but we got it with, you know, juicy thrills and, you know, rich dialogue and an A-list cast that could really carry it very well. With this, it's a little bit clumsy, and I think in an attempt to kind of hide the similarities to either, you know, there's like people have been drawing comparisons to Gossip Girl, Adolescence, The White Lotus, but to hide maybe the Big Little Lies thing, they've kind of added one too many tricks to the whole framing device. So there are flashes of too many different endings all over the place. So it's a little bit of a disorganized setup and a bit of a confused and crowded plot. But the central story is basically, you heard it there, there's a scandal in that school, there's a scandal in that community. We're headed towards this, basically, this party on the first week back in school for those girls, where the girls and all of their classmates, they attend an influencer's party, an influencer who has recently moved to the island. These people do not live on an island. That is actually how they refer to their town, so that they don't have to deal with anyone else around. And at this party, it's basically gay crashed by a lot of guys in balaclavas who wreck the place. And also, one of the girls that Allegra and Grace are friends with disappears that night, and a police investigation ensues. And nobody wants a police investigation in Richmond Lake. Not because it's basically the focus is not on the teenage girl going missing. Everybody is worried because every single member of this, you know, wealthy community has a secret that is somehow tied to this missing girl.
Okay, Jen, we've got the adult storylines and the teenage storylines. You like the teenage storylines best?
Yeah, I think that's the soul, the heart of this story. And what could be so great about this show is if they dispensed, leave the Big Little Lies, the parents' side of things away, just focus on the teens. And I think when it comes alive is when it focuses on the teens. And it's Nicole Leckie wrote Mood, and Mood was her one-woman show. And then it was adapted for the BBC. And that was about this aspiring rapper, Sasha, who was pulled into the world of social media, but also eventually sex work. And I think Wild Cherry is trying to explore the dark side of smartphones, of influencing, and how this new world of selfies and easy access to porn, teens can end up exploiting themselves and not understanding the consequences. Because within this sprawling story, Grace and Allegra have set up a private photo sharing ranking system within the school called the Catalogue, where you, members pay a fee to join and vote on explicit photos, judging who the hottest girl and the hottest boy is every week. And, you know, it's only a matter of time before they're rumbled by their parents. And Allegra is this very interesting character, I think. She is played by, I think, Amelia May is the actress's name. She's very good in it. She's a teen influencer and wants to further her reach by becoming friendly with this older rapper and influencer who has bought this house in Richmond Lake that Chris was talking about, where the party is. And it's where these parties happen, where they live stream, and the results could be a TikTok dance routine, drug taking, or these older men preying on these barely legal girls. And content houses are a big thing. They're nothing new. But in Wild Cherry, Riz House, like it's called, is very close to what we would know as bop houses, where the young girls exclusively create content for OnlyFans. So it is touching on the lifestyle that our teenagers are exposed to right now, and the influencer to sexualize content pipeline that they can drop into very quickly and very easily. And, you know, apps like OnlyFans and the career of Bonnie Blue, they're sold as something that's empowering for young women. And this show does try to delve into who exactly is in control, and can they understand those repercussions at the age of 16, 17? Are you emotionally equipped to deal with the potential fallout from these situations? And that's what's interesting. Everything else around it is just noise.
Mm. Chris, in terms of the show's creator, Nicole Leckie, she's the showrunner as well, and she's a writer, and she plays one of the roles in this as well. Is too much being asked of her?
I think so, yeah. And she's also adding too many ingredients to the plot as well, because the plot does get quite crowded, and she's also the narrator. This show doesn't really need a narrator. It's a show where the characters are constantly talking, so we don't need an extra voice in the room, so that starts to grate a little bit. I think there was two things here that sort of annoyed me. One was that it starts a lot of conversations, but it doesn't really know how to continue them. I think I do worry sometimes if we'll look back at these kinds of shows that try to say something about these, you know, rapid changes in technology and culture. I wonder if we'll look back at these shows the same way we look at, you know, shows and films about, you know, the beginnings of the internet in the 1990s and shake our heads and go, what were we thinking? Because all of this stuff is so new. It's all in its infancy that, you know, it's not enough to start a conversation about it. You know, if you're going to have a show where you're addressing those themes and those subjects that Jen was talking about, it needs to be something as good as Adolescence. Mm. It can't be just something like this. And I think the other side of it is that for, you know, the 100th time on Arena, I'm giving out a better program. The show's is too much from the end at the very beginning in order to bring us in. I want to go back and say, you would not pick up a book and start reading the final chapter before you even begin it. So there's no need to do that. There's a very interesting story here. There's a very interesting dynamic between the parents and their kids. And I think Leckie has a fabulous idea there. I just think she's added too much to it.
I think some people do that with books and they are wrong. Let's get stars. Go for it.
I think there are some great performances in here, especially from the younger cast, but I was a bit unconvinced by the whole thing, by it as a whole. So I'm going to have to go with 2.5.
Okay, Jen?
I just think it's, you know, it's a complex subject matter, and I think it deserves a better go at this. But I do admire Nicole Leckie for trying to tackle something that is such a big subject for so many young girls. I don't think it's necessarily scaremongering, but I don't think that every teen has a secret photo stash hidden behind a pretend calculator app on their phone, so don't worry. But I think it doesn't quite succeed for me, so 2.5.
Okay, Chris Wasser, Jen Gannon, thank you. As always, the episodes of The Beast in Me are now streaming on Netflix. Summer Water is on Channel 4 from Sunday at 9 p.m. And finally, you can find Wild Cherry on BBC One every Saturday at 9 p.m. You're listening to Friday Night's Arena. First up on our music reviews this week, Rosalía returns with Lux, her fourth album. The Catalan singer has built a career on bending genres from flamenco to experimental pop. This time she's diving into classical influences, orchestral arrangements and a concept inspired by female saints. We turn to Nightmares on Wax after that, the long-running project from Leeds producer George Evelyn. His new mixtape is called Echo 45 Sound System and looks back on his roots in reggae, pirate radio and soul, bringing in a host of collaborators to celebrate the sounds that shaped him. And finally, Blondshell, the singer-songwriter Sabrina Teitelbaum, releases Another Picture, where she explores identity, messy relationships and the lingering pull of adolescence with help from a few notable musical guests. I'm joined in studio by Louise Bruton and John Marr. John, cards on the table. I hadn't heard of Rosalía up until a couple of weeks ago, and then all of a sudden she was everywhere. So who is she?
She is a sensation in the Spanish-speaking world. She's a Catalan musician, 33 years old. This is album number 4. She was being described as the Rihanna of flamenco 6 years ago, and she was playing arenas at that stage. But you're absolutely right. The last couple of weeks, there has been mountains of hype about this particular musician, and it's all based around this fourth album, Lux, because critics are losing their mind about it. Tom Dunn during the week, the musician Tom Dunn of Something Happens, wrote that, and I paraphrase, that, you know, it's about as exciting for him as when he first heard Bohemian Rhapsody in terms of the sheer shock and awe of the music. So that's quite a way to describe something that does feel very different to anything else this year.
Okay, Louise, she's always moved between genres, some flamenco, some urban, some experimental pop. With this, it's now classical music. There's a full orchestra involved in this and some of the tracks as well. Does this feel like a kind of natural progression, an evolution, or does it feel like something else?
So the way that Rosalía has always approached music is that she would generally be fusing one form with another. So she made her debut as a flamenco singer, kind of stewing in the traditional. And then with her second album, which started as her college graduate project, which is an interesting thing, El Malquera, it is like a flamenco urbano kind of album, which, and she was getting the attention of a lot of hip hop artists across the world, particularly a lot of South American, kind of Latino speaking hip hop artists as well. And then Moto Mami, her 2022 album, was extremely experimental. It was like industrial pop in a sense. So she has surprised us at every turn. And then on this album as well, while she is borrowing a lot of kind of classical and operatic elements, she has the London Symphony Orchestra backing her up, which is, you know, that's fine company. But there's a lot of pop sentiments in there. There's a lot of, particularly, there's a lot of club inspiration, I feel, not just with the title, the lead single Burgein, which is named after the massive club in Berlin, which the track that features Bjork. It's not just everybody that can whip Bjork as a feature act on a song. And the experimental American artist Yves Tumor, who does an incredible experimental working of a Mike Tyson fight talk, intimidation speech. But there's a lot of deep bass that comes from, say, a double bass, I presume, that I feel imitates that deep, dark sound of the club. And it's just an incredible way, because when you start with one track, you're like, okay, this is going to be a banger in a sense, but then it becomes this orchestral, heavenly, divine intervention song.
Just before we play that track, Burgein, talk to me about that in and of itself, primarily because so Bjork appears on this album and she's collaborating on this. Anytime you bring Bjork into your song as a singer, you will then invite comparisons. Is this a good collaboration? Does it work?
This is an incredible collaboration, because it's more than just a meeting of minds, because there's Bjork, for as long as she's been making music, she always wants to defy expectations, and she seems to be thinking on a different stratosphere to everybody else. And she, you know, she challenges people, she challenges the listener. And Rosalía, in a lot of her interviews about this album as well, she's been asked, is she challenging her listeners too much? And she says, like, she just doesn't think that that's not that shouldn't be a difficult thing to do. We should be challenging our listeners. And when I'm listening to this album, I feel massively ignorant, but I'm thankful for the fact that I've been introduced to this album that brings in 14 different languages. And on my first listen, I was caught up on trying to understand what it all meant. But it's all about emotion, and that's the big part of this album.
Then let's hear some of it. Let's take Bergain from the album. That is a little of Björk at the end of Rosalía's Bergain. So, John, she's singing in 14 languages on this album, which is impossibly ambitious for any singer to do. Does that approach add depth to it?
I think it does, and because the first acquaintance is with the sheer chutzpah of everything that's happening here. There's just it doesn't matter that initially so much of the lyrics don't make sense. Although Apple Music, which is the one I use, you can see the translation happening in front of you if you hold the phone in front of you, so you can work out what she's singing. I did that maybe three or four listens in, because initially it's just that initial attack of music, exemplified by a song like that and a collaboration like Björk. Most of it is sung in Spanish. I mean, and obviously the Catalan language is there as well. There is plenty of English. There is just so much happening here, and in lesser hands, it would feel like a maximalist mess, a complete dog's dinner. And it's to her an eternal credit that it all hangs together wonderfully. And the sheer eclecticism of this album is mind-bending. Like, it's so difficult to categorize this.
Is there anybody else this year, Louise, who's made an album that's this ambitious?
No, absolutely not. She is an artist who wants to do things properly. So there's a huge amount of collaboration on this album across the board, in terms of she's got Fado singers, she's got Spanish flamenco singers, she has compositions done by members of Justice, Daft Punk, Pharrell Williams is here as producer, Charlotte Gainsbourg would have done some arrangements as well. When she was writing a lot of the lyrics, apparently she put it all just into Google Translate and was taking it on that. But even when she's singing in French, and when she's singing in Arabic, and she's singing in Japanese, she isn't doing just the straight-laced translations of these things. These are like local colloquialisms where she's paying honor to the actual native speakers of these languages, and she has so much grand fun with it as well. There's one song, La Perla, which is this takedown of her ex, which feels like a grand waltz that you would see in a Rodgers and Hammerstein production. Like, if only Julie Andrews had the chutzpah to sing something like that in a grand ballroom.
Okay, let's get stars.
Oh, five and more if possible.
John?
Yeah, five. It's a magnificent album. I mean, it'll be up at the top at pretty much all those end of year lists.
Okay, the highest possible praise for Rosalía's Lux. Nightmares on Wax have been around since the late 80s, spanning everything from Ibiza chill to hip hop to reggae influenced beats. So where does Echo 45 Sound System sit in his catalogue, Louise?
So this is seeped in nostalgia, and I think that this is probably at a moment in George Evelyn's life where he's a bit like marking how far he's come, and paying homage to the people that inspired him from when he was a child, and then working all of his way up through his adulthood and all of the other musicians that he has respected and collaborated with over the years. So it's a journey of being a music fan and taking on things like soul, roots, hip hop, dub, electronic, and this mixtape feel. This is a classic mixtape in the sense that pirate radio, which would have been a very important part of a lot of people's lives, not so important now because I think it barely exists. I don't know. But it's like stepping back in time. Even though I wouldn't have been wandering the streets of Camden Town in the 80s, I feel like there's a lot of tracks that are bringing me in there, particularly a song called Desire, which features the MC Liam Bailey. And it's reminiscent of a lot of like great Jamaican reggae, like Billy Boyo's One Spliff a Day. This is just what I'm thinking of a lot. There's a lot of Jamaican reggae roots that so many producers and DJs have sampled over the years. But instead of making it feel feel like this is just him trying to be as showy with his samples as possible. It's seamless production.
Okay, let's have a listen to something from it. This is Nightmares on Wax. This is Desire. Okay, John, there's a lot of guest voices on the album. Does it all cohere together? Does it make sense as an album or as a mixtape?
Oh, it absolutely does. And there's an intriguing track at the end, which effectively is one continuous mix of everything we've heard before, the 14 tracks previously, and that's the way to listen to it. 45 minutes of just an adventure, an aural adventure that incorporates all these different people, including Gree T. Peng, like this gorgeous track called I Remember. It's a Fugees referencing stream of consciousness song, and her vocals are fantastic. The production is so good throughout. I mean, this is album number 10 for this guy. As you said, Rick, he's been around since the late 80s. He's the longest serving person on the roster of Warp Records, you know, that seminal label. He knows his stuff around a mixing desk, and you can hear it here time and again.
Okay, let's take actually a quick moment about something else from it as well. This is a track called Bang Bien. Nightmares on Wax, Bang Bien, and that features Yassine Bey, the artist formerly known as Mos Def, on that. Let's finish up with this. Let's get stars. Louise, what do you think?
This is a nice, cool 4 for me.
Okay, John?
I'm afraid I have to agree with Louise again. It's a very, very good album.
You're just copying me now.
I enjoyed it immensely. 4 stars.
You say that like it's a bad thing. Let's take a break, and after this, we'll check out the Blonde Shell album, Another Picture. This is Friday Night's Arena, and we are on our final album. Blonde Shell leans heavily on that kind of 90s alt-rock sound, even though she's only 28. John, this is framed as a companion piece to another album called If You Asked for a Picture, but that's not really what it is.
No, and that really annoys me, because the second album, If You Asked for a Picture, was released in May of this year. It's a very good album. This album, released by Partisan Records, best known as the home of Fontaine's DC for many years. Effectively what this is just a few bonus tracks cobbled on. I mean, it's not a companion album. There's only one new track that appears alongside the album that we heard a number of months ago. The rest of it, she invites some of her friends, people like Conor Oberst along to rework some of the tracks, and then there's a live track cobbled on at the end. Give me a break. You know, this is deluxe bonus material gone mad. And it's not just the major labels that are doing this and kind of wrecking music with it. It's some of the indies as well. And it has to stop.
This is the angriest I've ever seen you. Okay, Louise, there are themes in this album for people who maybe haven't heard it first time around earlier this year. They're about things like control and about relationships and about trying to present a clearer portrait of herself. When you listen to them together, does that make sense, or does it feel like a bunch of snapshots from different places?
So you really can't listen to Another Picture without listening to If You Asked for a Picture, which is the first friend of this album. So a lot of it is, so she's 28 years of age, but she seems to be perpetually stuck in this kind of teenage adolescence. And a lot of those themes are kind of finding love and validation in all of these wrong places, like toxic relationships, you know, dabbling in drugs and, you know, not having daddy issues that transfer onto all of the wrong people, which, you know, it's quite a common thing for a lot of people. But there's a song called 23 is a Baby, which gets a sort of cover remix treatment on the new LP. But it's a very literal song where it goes, if 23 is a baby, why do you have a baby? Sings the 28-year-old. And it's this fear of herself becoming a parent and then being confused as to why people in her circle are also becoming parents. But she herself had a very strange kind of upbringing in that her mother was barely present and died when she was 2018. And she seems to just kind of be looking for, you know, a new family in the guise of good time people who are bad people at their core.
Well, then let's have a listen to that. This is 23's a Baby. That is Blonde Shell from another picture. It's called 23's a Baby. John, does this album feel nostalgic in a good way, or is it like she's still trying to figure out her own identity here?
Oh, definitely in a good way. I mean, I love 90s music. I mean, Riot Girl stuff and grunge, and she adores grunge. I mean, she was born in 98, so grunge had kind of come and gone by then, but she really seizes upon that with some kind of modern pop sensibilities as well. She does make it her own, I think, to a large degree. And in fairness to the bonus tracks, of which we've heard just one there, she has reinvented the songs quite well. And I just think there's something quite special about her. Her first album from 2 years ago, self-titled album, really felt like the arrival of somebody special. And this particular project this year has shown that she really is a real deal, I think.
Okay, what do you make of the bonus and the expanded tracks, Louise, and even the live versions of her own songs? Do they add to this?
There's one song in particular, Event of Fire, which Conor Oberst covers. So her vocals are taken away and he takes over. So this song she had initially written when she was staying in a Holiday Inn when she was on tour and the fire alarm went off, and she, being the daredevil that she is, went down in the lift, which you're not meant to do if there's a fire, if there's a risk of fire. And there's a nice metaphor in that, taking the lift down in a burning building. And Oberst then sings that song, kind of capturing the real vulnerability of something that she feels. It's this destruction that she leads her life with, and when he takes this on in his very kind of dour but melodic kind of way, we learn that her largely specific songwriting is actually quite universal, so it turns it on its head.
Okay, give me some stars.
Oh, 3 for me.
Okay.
Despite my rant about Partisan Records, it's a solid 4.
John Maher, Louise Bruton, thank you very much. We've been reviewing Rosalía's Lux, Nightmares on Wax's Echo 45 Sound System, and Blonde Shell's Another Picture. And that is it for Arena for the Week. Tonight, produced by Sinead Egan, Leah Murphy is our researcher. Broadcast coordinator tonight was Ollie Hamilton, and it was Tommy O'Sullivan on sound. Have a lovely weekend. Stay safe wherever you are. John Creedon is next after the news.